Hi, I'm Rabbi Ari Goldstein, and you're listening to Drinking and Droshing Torah with a Twist. And be sure to listen to old records of The Police with Sting.
Hey, Manda. Manda? Manda!
Gabe, you looking for Amanda?
I'm looking for Amanda. Where is she?
I mean, I don't know. I thought you were the one who lived with her.
I mean, she's not in her room. She's not at her desk. I don't really know what's going on. Are we going to be able to do this episode without her?
Have we done an episode without Amanda before?
I think we did. I remember something really cheesy.
I think cheese was definitely involved the last time. Hope we don't do that again.
Yeah, no, I think we'll probably get a little less sidetracked this time. I'm really excited. We have a really great guest who I know and work with, and it's going to be great. So very excited. Talking about Parashat Bo. Let's go. Another week, another Torah portion, and today we're talking about Parashat Bo with my friend and mentor, and sometimes boss, supervisor, Rabbi Ari Goldstein. Rabbi Ari Goldstein was born in Baltimore, Maryland, but grew up in New Orleans, Louisiana, a place he still calls his hometown. He graduated college at the University of Pittsburgh and was ordained in 1997 by the Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion in Cincinnati. He served congregations in Glencoe, Illinois, and Cherry Hill, New Jersey, before coming to Temple Beth Shalom in 2004, which is where I am now a cantorial intern. Rabbi Goldstein is a gifted teacher, an inspiring speaker, and a passionate Zionist. His sermons have been included in various national compilations, and he was an essayist for the recent publication of Sacred Journeys, Ecumenical Perspectives on Spiritual Care. From 2016 to 2018, Rabbi Goldstein was the president of the Synagogue Division for Israel Bonds, and he has served as a consultant to the Anne Arundel County School Board for Middle East Curriculum. Rabbi Goldstein is married to Rabbi Hannah Yerushalmi, a licensed therapist, and they have four children, Sela, Nava, Sammy, and Judah. Rabbi Goldstein, welcome to the show. Ari, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Wow, this is really cool to be here. Thanks, Gabe.
Thank you. Good to see you as well. And of course, we have to welcome our executive producer, Edan Waldman. How you doing, Edan?
Doing great. Love to know that you have to introduce me, and it's definitely not because I'm the executive producer.
I should also say that Amanda is very sorry she couldn't join us today. She is, as a fifth-year rabbinical student, going through the rabbinic job search process, which is super fun and not at all stressful. So she is off at some interviews right now. We wish her the best of luck, and we know that everything is going to be awesome. So with that, let's start the show. You might remember from last week that God has hardened Pharaoh's heart, which seems like kind of counterproductive to the whole let my people go thing, but that's what the plagues are for. God wants to show God's awesome power, so it's plague time. Last week we had blood, frogs, lice, wild beasts, cattle disease, boils, and a furious thunderstorm of hail and fire. In Bo, God follows up with a 1-2 punch of locust and darkness. As it is said, I send the locust on a whim such as the world has never seen, on every leaf, on every stalk, until there's nothing left of green. No, that's not Torah. It's the plague song from our favorite documentary, The Prince of Egypt. Incidentally, also my ringtone. After the locust, Pharaoh pleads for forgiveness and God removes the locust, but never mind, says Pharaoh, the Israelites are still enslaved. So God causes darkness to fall upon Egypt for 3 whole days. The people couldn't see each other and nobody could move, but the Israelites still had light. Nice. Pharaoh summons Moses and tries once again to bargain to remove the plague, but Pharaoh still will not let the Israelites go free. So God tells Moses of the final plague, the worst of all, sure to get Pharaoh to free the Israelites. God tells Moses to have the Israelites collect all of their valuables so that they can escape on a moment's notice. Moses warns Pharaoh of what will befall the Egyptians. A horrible cry will be heard throughout the land as God takes the life of every firstborn Egyptian, from the royalty to the livestock. But Pharaoh's heart still remains hardened at God's command. God instructs Moses that on the 10th of the month, which is, by the way, the first month, Happy New Year, each family shall take a perfect, unblemished lamb to be slaughtered on the night of the 14th. They shall take blood of the lamb and put it on the doorposts of their house and eat the roast meat of the lamb that same night. No leftovers allowed. But remember, eat it quick with your sandals all laced up. You have to be ready to run. So what's the blood about? Well, it's a sign that God will pass over, hey, that sounds familiar, the houses of the Israelites and kill only the Egyptians. So this is Passover, a day of remembrance with the lamb and the 7 days of unleavened bread, also no working on the first and seventh day. This shall be a festival for all time. So God sweeps through Egypt, killing every firstborn except those in the houses with the blood on the doorposts. And just as Moses warned Pharaoh, a loud cry erupts in Egypt, for there was no Egyptian household where none had died. Finally, Pharaoh casts out the Israelites along with their livestock, fearing what could possibly come next. The Israelites don't even have enough time to let the bread rise. I guess that's what the whole unleavened bread thing from earlier was about. Nice foreshadowing, Torah. 600,000 Israelite men go out from the city of Ramses, and that's just the men in fighting shape. After exactly 430 years, the Israelites are finally free. And so, with that freedom, it's time for some laws. That lamb we talked about earlier, that's only for the Israelites and for their circumcised slaves. The meat can't be taken outside, and the bones have to stay intact. Addendum, there shall be one law for the citizen and the stranger who dwells among you. So the Israelites venture forth toward the land flowing with milk and honey, the land of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Hivites and the Jebusites that was promised to the patriarchs. And for all time and all generations, the people will observe the festival of unleavened bread, explaining to their children, "It is because of what the Eternal did for me when I went free from Egypt." The firstborn of every Israelite family, the children and the livestock, belongs to the Eternal to be redeemed with an offering of a sheep. And when your children ask why, you will tell them the story of how God freed the Israelites from Egypt. All of this shall be a sign on your hand and a reminder on your forehead for God's teaching to be in your mouth. With a mighty hand, the Eternal freed you from Egypt. Mighty hand, outstretched arm, heavy pour. That's Parashat Bo.
Wow. Wow, wow. Gabe, man, that's thorough. I'll tell you something. It's no surprise that you are doing some extra writing and research on the Prince of Egypt. You seem to have a love of this story and what's happening. It's amazingly thorough. You know, I'll tell you my favorite part of that Torah portion, I mean, really, is the part about how we, you know, make matzah because we don't have enough time to let the bread rise. Yeah, like really, I mean, I that one is about as hard for me to believe as anything. Was it that much time that we had that we didn't have an extra, let's say, half an hour to let the bread rise? We had enough time to go and exhume Joseph's bones from the Nile River. We have enough time to go and borrow all of the gold and silver from our friends, the Egyptians, and their houses, because we look forward to giving that back to them when we, you know, get back to when we get to Israel or to Canaan. But, you know, we don't have enough time for the bread to rise. I always found there to be something mildly suspicious about this whole 20 minute, you know, this whole not enough time. We're out there in such a hurry. What did they think, that Pharaoh was going to change his mind in that, you know, in the extra 20 minutes that it took for the bread to rise? I'm thinking something suspicious is going on here. We're going to have to get to the bottom of that.
Interesting. Do you have any theories?
I mean, Yeah, I've got theories. I think this is just a really sweet birth story for our people about rushing to get out. And it's mixed with a lot of history. You know, like, why is it that we borrowed stuff from our neighbor, from these Egyptian neighbors, as we didn't? We stole it from them as we were rushing out. And why is it that Pharaoh was so mad that he changed his mind and chased us down at the Sea of Reeds? It's because, you know, he heard that we had taken all the stuff from, we had plenty of time to leave, I think. I think when the authors of the Torah were writing a narrative about our people and realized that maybe we were a little bit more ferocious than originally thought, they had to kind of dial it back a little and suggest that, we were in such a rush that we, you know, only had a short amount of time to bake bread. It's kind of like the whole Torah, but this story specifically, the story of the Exodus from Egypt, I mean, it's remarkably suspicious in terms of the reality and the history versus the myth, which I'm fine with the myth. I love the myth, but I just also like the history too. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. I'm really excited to get into some more analysis and to talk about you and your work. So one thing I've noticed in my time as the intern at Rabbi Ari's Temple at Beth Shalom in Arnold, Maryland, one of the things I've noticed is that Ari tends to do a lot of different things. Every day I'll go in and something will be going on, and Ari will either be typing away at his email, he'll be plucking at his guitar, maybe he'll be setting up a projector for an event that's happening later. He's got his feet in a lot of different puddles. And what's really incredible about that is that when you're the leader of a community, you kind of have to not only oversee everything, but you have to get your hands dirty. You have to understand what's going on and really be involved in that process. One of the things that I think is really interesting about how you work, Ari, are the ways in which you teach. Specifically, I've seen you teach adult ed. I've seen you teach small children. I've seen you teach, you know, somewhere in between. And you have such an authenticity about you that it's very down to earth. It's very, you know, let's just talk about this thing because I'm interested in it, because I'm passionate about it. You know, you don't really just lecture at people. Even when you're giving a sermon, you speak off the cuff, off of, you know, maybe some bullet pointed notes for the most part, but you speak really from the heart. And so I'm curious kind of how you get there. You know, when I need to give a devar or an iyun, when I need to say something in a service, I have to write out almost verbatim what I'm going to say because I'm worried about, you know, not getting it right. When I teach, I have to write out a whole lesson plan because I'm so nervous that I'm going to forget something important or that I'm not going to go in the right direction. So I'm curious, how did you get to where you are and what drives all of it?
Well, first of all, thank you. So it's a really nice compliment and I really appreciate it. And I mean, well, first of all, you said that I have my hand in a lot of different things. And the truth is that, you know, when you're a rabbi in a smaller congregation as this is, and we're kind of a small, mid-sized, small congregation, you end up being on many levels the chief cook and bottle washer for a lot of things. You can either assume that someone else will take care of it or differently, you can have an arrogance that suggests that you're above doing these things, or you can just say, hey, our job and our common goal is to accomplish things and how we do it, let's all get our hands dirty and make sure that we do what we want to accomplish. It's really kind of, you know, not taking yourself so seriously and not being so stuffy about what a rabbi is or should be. I mean, that's kind of from a previous generation, I think. So, but thank you for the compliments. And regarding the kind of speaking off the cuff or with a few notes, and that's a skill that I managed to get over years, Gabe. It's not something that you just, you know, that came naturally to me. I'll share with you a fun story about it, which is that I remember my first synagogue in Glencoe at North Shore Congregation Israel, which I loved being there. I worked with a rabbi named Rabbi Stephen Mason, just a phenomenal person. And Jordan Milstein was a co-rabbi with me. Richard Cohn was the cantor there. And a phenomenal experience. And I remember I would write down everything. And, you know, and I would go over my text, you know, dozens of times to make sure my delivery was just right. And, you know, and then I went to my second synagogue, which was in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And there I worked with a rabbi named Barry Schwartz, who's an excellent, excellent human being also. And he'd worked from notes. And I asked him, should I be writing these things out? And he said, you can do whatever you want. I just put notes down because I just don't really have the time to write a sermon. And I said, all right, well, let me give it a try. And I can remember like challenging myself, saying, I'm going to learn this. I'm going to do this. I'm going to get out of my comfort zone. So I just want you to know that give it time. It's like it wasn't something that just happened automatically. It was something that I worked at. And it's something which I like because it does give me the capacity to kind of be more eye to eye with people and to kind of make it more conversational as opposed to me just kind of lecturing them. And I suspect that that's just kind of also a big part of how the rabbinate and how synagogue life is changing. Look, I think, you know, my dad's a rabbi. He's retired now, but he was ordained in 1965. So a long time ago. And he came into the rabbinate with a vision and an idea of what it meant to be a rabbi, which was, you know, you studied the New York Times, and then you gave out a sermon topic, and then people would come and listen to your take on what the New York Times had to say. And that was what it meant to be a rabbi. And really, like, sermonizing was the thing. And I also think, though, that giving a sermon is not as significant now as it once was. I mean, I think that so many people have the access to so many different people's ideas that it's less important, I think, for me to be, you know, sermonizing, and more important for me just to be enabling a conversation for people to kind of share their own thoughts and ideas. And obviously in synagogue and services, rather, it's a little harder to do that. But so therefore, I kind of take it down a notch in terms of the preaching. I do it on the high holidays, but Shabbat, I just let it be kind of more conversational so people feel like it's more authentic and more me, for that matter. But thank you. And yes, teaching is something which has really been a joy for me. I think that for rabbis, and I think also cantors too, I think that especially as we get a little bit longer into our careers, we start to cherish the teaching a little bit more than we did in the past. I remember when I was first starting as a rabbi back in North Shore Congregation Israel, I was terrified when I was teaching. I was convinced that the people I taught knew more than me. And in fact, in many cases, they did, right? And so the only leg up I had on them at the time was I knew what part I was teaching, right? And so they knew everything better. I just knew the narrow thing that I was teaching better. But I was terrified. I was like right out of HUC. I was like, I don't know, you know, any of this. I learned so much of it on the job. But as years have gone on, and I was terrified of teaching because I was scared that they were going to find out that I was a fraud. But over years, you know, you come to really cherish the teaching and you start to embrace things which are really important to you. And you realize that you start to, you know, so I'm not going to teach anything. Like if someone said, oh, we want you to teach a class on Kabbalah, and I'll probably say, it's, you know, I could do some research into it, but it's really not my thing. So I don't want to teach about Kabbalah. Rather, let me teach about the things that bring me real joy. And what are those things? Text, Talmud, Torah. I just love teaching it. That's been an acquired taste for me over the years. So for Torah, for example, you know, we've had a Torah study here that's been going for 18 years and now a new kind of Talmud study that we do, which is just fun and exciting for me because it's teaching, but has started to rise in my priorities. There's no doubt about it. You know, I was thinking, can we talk about the Torah portion a little bit, Gabe, or do you?
Absolutely. Yeah.
I was thinking about, like, for example, these plagues. Let's talk about darkness for a minute because it's such a interesting, right? It's the ninth plague. And I guess I've always kind of been under the impression that the plagues went in order of severity, right? Because the 10th plague was the straw that broke the camel's back, right? But the presumption was, and I'm not so sure it's true or not, but the presumption was that they kept bringing a new plague because hopefully this one would push Pharaoh over the edge, even though we know, right, that God hardened Pharaoh's heart. And so Pharaoh on many levels didn't even have a choice in the matter. But, you know, we always thought, okay, this one was pushing Pharaoh over the edge. And so in my mind, I was always under the impression that they got progressively harsher. We get to this 9th plague, which is darkness. Now, I won't call out anybody's name, but, and I don't get migraine headaches. But for people who do get migraine headaches, right, they would say the darkness is hardly a plague, but it's like a respite. It's like the heavens have opened up and smiled down on them when they have a migraine headache, and it's just dark and calm and everything, right? How many people would say that darkness is hardly a plague at all, but rather it's joy to get a little bit of, you know, we even have room darkening shades. We like the darkness, right? And so here it is, the 9th plague, one shy of death of the firstborn Egyptian, right? It's like, it's puzzling, right? And so you got to wonder, like, what's this darkness thing all about? And I've thought about it a lot, but I don't know if I know the actual answer, but I've thought about it a lot. What do you think?
You know, in looking at the text, looking at Exodus chapter 10, verse 22, the Hebrew used for the darkness is actually two words. It's choshech afela, which basically means dark darkness. Like there's no, those are kind of synonyms. It's choshech meaning darkness and afela meaning also darkness. So I struggle with, you know, should it be just an emphatic? You know, we read tzedek, tzedek, tirdof, and we know that tzedek is repeated because it's an emphatic. You're really supposed to pursue tzedek, pursue justice. But this isn't the same word that's used, right? It's two different words. And so I think we have to, you know, look a little bit deeper into what each of those two words is. Because choshech really is just darkness. It's choshech and or are opposites, or being light. And that we get as early as creation. But this afela has more of a connotation of a calamity or of wickedness or something really terrible happening. So I'm curious about that, about how, you know, why doesn't it just say darkness, but instead says it's a wicked darkness.
That sounds like a guy who's from Boston that you would have used that description. Wicked,
it's wicked, wicked dark.
Wicked dark, right?
Wicked dark outside. You know, it's not the, you know, deep darkness of Psalm 23 of, you know, the valley of the shadow of death. It's not Psalm Mavet. So I wouldn't really go in that direction, but I have to believe that this isn't just darkness, that there's something beyond just like the sunset. I'm curious because in that next verse, it says that people couldn't see one another and nobody could move. People were stuck. So what does that mean to you? How do you interpret that?
Right. I know it's like, so I'll tell you, well, first of all, you know, it's like, the previous time that it spoke about darkness is in a story about when darkness overtakes someone, is in the story of Abraham, when during the covenant of the pieces, which is right after, I think it's chapter 14 or 15 in Lech Lecha, and he goes to sleep, and it talks about like a deep dark dread coming over him, and so there's no doubt that when I see darkness, I'm definitely also ascribing like dread to it, not just dark. But you're right. It's like they couldn't move. They were, you know, it talks about what they're stuck in one place. They couldn't, no one could move to the left or to the right, right? But even that seems absurd when you think about it, right? Because what do they not have, candles in, you know, in Egypt? No lanterns. We get the fact that maybe it was during the daytime, it was like an eclipse or something, and it was dark during the daytime, but they really had nothing they could see. It was just pitch black and they couldn't see around them. It just seems so kind of crazy. So maybe, I think perhaps that maybe it has to do with, like, think about it, like when a person kind of, if I were to say to you, like, that I had gone into kind of a very dark place, you know, if I use that expression, right, you might think that I'm talking, rightfully so, well, it could be just kind of nasty, that, but that's not what I'm, but it could also be some, you know, a person who's going into like a deep melancholy or even depression, right? And so if it's, I mean, what would happen maybe if it was like a darkness of depression that kind of set over everybody, which, you know, now that kind of, you know, that they couldn't interact with people and they couldn't leave their homes. Now suddenly it's starting to kind of make a lot of sense to me if that's the case. And I'm not sure. I'm just kind of aware of that possibility. That becomes a very real reading, right, of this text. And especially more and more, I've noticed in the last 10 years of my career, let's say, as opposed to the first 15 years and prior, mental illness is really something that has, obviously it's been around, you know, people have just been more aware or afraid to talk about it. But even with the fact that people feel more comfortable talking about it, I still feel like it's kind of at a greater level than it's ever been before. And I wonder, you know, when I think about darkness and I think about the idea of melancholy or depression, I'm like really kind of affected by it. And I realize, well, then maybe it really is the ninth plague. I mean, because can you imagine if everyone was walking around just kind of depressed, sad, and they just, no one wanted to leave their homes and no one wanted to really interact. That would be worse than locusts to me. You know, that would be certainly worse than blood in the river and frogs and cattle disease. I could handle all that stuff. But if everyone was just walking around depressed, boy, I think that might push me over the edge, to be sure. But then I was like thinking about, like, you're about to say something. I want to, you have a thought?
I mean, I'm thinking about Pharaoh's hardened heart. And about how that's always been the part of not just this portion, but like this whole let my people go narrative that spans a couple of Torah portions. That just doesn't make sense to me, that God hardens Pharaoh's heart.
Right. God wants Pharaoh to say no.
Right. God causes Pharaoh to say no. And so now we're going through all of these plagues. It's really confusing to me. You know, are all of these plagues just part of God's plan from the beginning? Did God know it was going to take 10 plagues from the very start of it? From the very start of it, did God know that God was going to have to kill every firstborn Egyptian?
Right. And if that's the case, boy, it's a little harsh to think about it, right? I think that
theology.
Right. We feel a whole lot better thinking that Pharaoh was the one who said no. And every time we come across that part where it says, but God hardened Pharaoh's heart, we have a little, our stomachs turn a little bit every time we read that, because we think, really, is that means that maybe Pharaoh would have said, go ahead after the frogs? Right. And we wouldn't have had to go through all this stuff, and you wouldn't have to inflict a lot of unnecessary pain and suffering on a lot of people in the process. I mean,
right. I mean, to me, I'm thinking about like a hardened heart, and you have this kind of element of the depression or, darkness that people are feeling. You have both of those things together. And then the final 10th plague, a cry arose from Egypt and everybody was yelling and shouting and screaming and nobody was unaffected. And that's when Pharaoh lets the people go. It's after all of this dark energy has built up over time and suddenly there's this massive release. A great cry arose in Egypt that finally the people are let go. So that I think is an interesting way to look at it, of not just like, you know, a succession of plagues, but really building the plagues that were building to a final element there.
Right. And maybe that depression darkness was never really a plague, but just a symptom of what had been going on after, you know, they had been through a lot of other hardships along the way. By the way, that whole concept of the cry that was heard throughout Egypt, I mean, there is this notion of the concept of doubling in the, you know, in the Torah, in which things kind of happen in pairs, or oftentimes, you know, what comes around goes around. I think it was at the first portion, Shemot, in which it talked about how, you know, God hears the cries of the Israelites, right? And so they definitely wanted to make sure there was a cry of Egyptians to mirror the cry of the Israelites. I mean, they were waiting for a reason to do it. But still, I do think that there is something to be said about how perhaps there was that the darkness and the depression maybe was really a symptom of the previous plagues. But there's so many other possibilities, right? Because like in my mind, this is the other part of me. That's the rabbi in me that's like interpreting the exegesis and the just the interpretation of the text. But then there's the reform, you know, because when I was at HUC, and I'm sure it's still happening now, they were really pushing in us, you know, the documentary hypothesis and studying this text as a historical document, not necessarily as a religious document. And so my mind is kind of tickled by that notion of, you know, I'm hearing the Michael Cook in the background, professor of mine, and, you know, but even though he didn't say this, but I'm hearing him say this, you know, darkness is a rejection of the sun. And Ra was the sun god, right? And was such and probably the most significant god in the pantheon of gods of the Egyptians at the time. And I wonder if that darkness wasn't a strong rejection of Ra. Our god, Adonai, has the capacity to eliminate the job of the chief god Ra, which is provide light from the sun. And our god Adonai can just, no problem, goodbye Ra. It's all, you know, there's a new sheriff in town. And his name is Adonai. That's my, I think it was called 48 Hours. There was a movie with Eddie Murphy and Nick Nolte. New sheriff in town, his name is Billy Ray, something or other. I'm misquoting. But nonetheless, I think that, you know, I'm really like affected by that possible reading of it too. It's just like, so this notion of darkness has always, especially from the first thought, which was, yeah, people kind of like the dark, right? It's like, it doesn't bug them, right? You know, when you're in Israel and people are partying, they're not partying at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. They're partying at 2 o'clock in the morning, right? People love it when it gets dark. You know, it's part of like it's like a new world for them. And I think that there has to be something more than just dark, especially when you've got candles, right? Maybe not electricity, but at least candles. There has to be something more to this than just mere darkness, but who knows? But it's like fun, right? And studying this text from a historical perspective and from a biblical criticism perspective is fascinating. And this one of all is so fascinating, right? Because Rashi talks about in the first, I think it's literally on Genesis 1:1, Rashi says, you know, why didn't the Torah really kind of begin here? Instead, why did we have the book of Genesis? The Torah should really begin here. And on many levels, I mean, there's a lot of truth to that, right? It's like, you know, we know of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and Joseph as being kind of the patriarchs of our people, but we really don't. And we've kind of created this story around Abraham as being the first Jew and God called him. But I think we kind of know that the book of Genesis is a mere introduction to how and why it is that we got to Egypt. And our story is a story about being brought out of Egypt. In fact, even slavery, in my opinion, is a myth. I don't believe we were slaves in Egypt. I'm relatively certain, although I certainly could be wrong, that the Levites were the ones who were in Egypt. And the Levites were a group of people who were loyal to the pharaoh named Akhenaten, who was the only monotheistic pharaoh in Egypt in the history of the, in the ancient history of Egyptian pharaohs. And that there was one monotheistic pharaoh, and then before him it was not, and after him it was not monotheism, but the one monotheistic pharaoh, and the exodus from Egypt should happen so soon after that, suggests to me that the exodus from Egypt was of a people who were loyal to monotheism and were kicked out. Freud writes in his book, a book called Moses and Monotheism, I think is the name of the book, in which he talks about, and I fully believe this, that Moses was a priest of the god Aten, who was the one god in Egypt during the time of Akhenaten. And that Moses was simply an Egyptian priest who led his loyalists out of Egypt, right? Let my people go so they can serve, so they can work, worship me. It's like the concept was, at first it wasn't about leaving Egypt. It was about letting these people find a way to worship Adonai, who was their God up until, just prior. And that's why, and we left. And so Moses, you know what the word is? By the way, it's a great expression, the Hebrew for this mixed multitude that left with Moses. Do you know what it's called? Erev Rav is the words that are used, which I love because that's what Amanda, right? Isn't she an Erev Rav? She is on the Erev Rav. And so the very word that's used to describe the mixed multitude that went out with Egypt is also the word that's used to describe the, what a rabbi is, right before he or she is ordained. And although, it's the Erev, the Rav in the case of Erev Rav is the multitude as opposed to the rabbi. But still, the point is, it's funny, it's the same word. But this Erev Rav, this mixed multitude of people went out of Egypt with Moses. What's that? Are they suggesting that it was more than the Israelites that were leaving Egypt? Probably so, right? It probably was a bunch of people who were just different, but they were all supporters of monotheism, and they left because they wanted to bring monotheism. That's our birth story, right? But it's not as fun or it's not as meaningful to us when we say, we're an offshoot, right? No one likes the synagogue that's a break-off synagogue never likes to talk about how they're just a break-off from this other synagogue. Instead, they like to talk about all of the things that make them unique and led them to this place that there we are, this new synagogue, right? Same thing with us and Judaism in general. We don't want to talk about how, we were just kind of like this disposed offshoot of Egyptian theology that was really never really embraced, but rather we like to think of this great birth narrative of how we were slaves and how this land was promised to us, by God, and here we are, and God freed us by showing off God's power, and now we made it out of Egypt. And that's a much better story. And I like that story. And that's the one I'm sticking to, even though I know it's just not historical. Right.
I mean, there's something that everybody loves about like an underdog narrative. Right. Everybody wants to see the little guy succeed. And there's no better underdog Cinderella story than the Israelites going from slavery to the promised land, the land flowing with milk and honey. We get that in this Torah portion, that God is bringing the people to the promised land, or God will bring the people to the promised land. So I know we don't have a ton of time left, but I know that you do a lot of work, that you have done a lot of work, and you continue to do a lot of work advancing the cause of Zionism and of a Jewish home in that ancestral homeland. So I know we cannot get into a whole political crazy discussion right now, but I'm wondering if you can speak to that a little bit in light of this Torah portion. We're talking about this darkness and the cry that erupts in Egypt and all of these horrible things, and it's all in service to this journey to this place.
Yeah, it's like when you think about it, what is Zionism other than a person's love for a place and our hopes for what it can be? right? That's what Moses was all about, was bringing us to this place so we can create a place that is unique and special, and that we can worship God. And what is Theodor Herzl's vision about, other than we need a place that's not just a place, a safe haven for Jews, but also a place that we've been crying out for all these years, the place which is Israel. You know, that's the story of A.D. Gordon when he was, you know, during the, you know, first Aliyah period, when he was like a camp counselor to all these 17-year-old kids who were coming from Europe and settling into this. Let's take this place and embrace it and claim it and make it what we want it to be and what we hope it can be. And that's been my, you know, vision too, which is that I'm aware that Israel's not perfect. And I'm aware that it can be very frustrating at times, but it's ours and it's our homeland. And, you know, it's easy for people who live there, students from HCU who spent the year there, get all, you know, they see kind of Israel and a lot of the nasty sides of it. It's true. But also when you take a person to Israel for the first time and they're seeing this land for the first time and you see the joy that they experience by setting foot on our ancestral homeland, it's like, it's so special and so meaningful. And I just feel like that's what I like to tap into, the feelings of what Israel can be and how it can influence people and how it can inspire people. And not, again, I'm not trying to ignore some of the nasty parts, but it doesn't have to be just angry about, you know, Israel for all of the different things, because there's so much to love about that place. And I choose to put myself in the being very real about Israel, but choosing to be myself and one of the lovers of Israel, one of the Chovavei Tzion, you know, just like I'm just a lover of our ancestral home, because I know what this place has meant to me and I know what it's meant to our people. And I know how much I would feel at such a loss if it wasn't there. I would be a shell of who I am as a human being if it wasn't there. So yeah, Israel is as deep to me as just about anything. In fact, I'd argue that it is the primary thing that drives my Judaism and even my rabbinate is Zionism in Israel. And that may change, but certainly for the last 10 or 15 or 20 years, at least, that's been what's driven me as a rabbi, no doubt.
What I love about the way you're framing that is that it's all about hope and it's all about continual improvement. It's not about, you know, Masada will not fall again, we are here and we're done. There's no finality to it. It's constant improving. You know, it's, as you said, it's not just Herzl's vision of, you know, a safe haven for Jews. It's not just Der Judenstaat. It's also Altneuland. It's also that kind of utopian almost vision of here's what we can be. We can aspire to greatness. We can do better. And that kind of aspiration, I think, is so present in Torah in general, in our tradition in general, this idea of, you know, be a light unto the nations, be a just people, always be striving to, you know, do justice, love mercy, walk humbly. All of these kind of foundational ideas are all about that aspiration to continually improve and continually being better.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I agree. Beautiful how you describe it. And I agree with you fully. And I think that Israel, it's to ignore its warts is to not be real about what Israel is. But to focus purely on its warts is to then not be fair to Israel. And also not, and to choose to hold a grudge against Israel is not loving the place that has always loved us back. And yep, it's not going to be perfect. But then again, America's not perfect either. My God, it's not perfect, right? But the irony is we hold Israel to a level of perfection because we know that's what we want from it, right? And so that means, like, just like you're saying, it's like we expect and we can grow. We're not satisfied and complacent with where we are. We can grow and be a better place. And I think that that's really not just, and isn't that amazing that Israel of all places, right? It's a place in which people living in the diaspora can have just as much of an opinion and a say in another country as the people who are living there. That's amazing, right? What other country is like that? Nowhere. Vatican, maybe, but not really.
Vatican's one of the last remaining total monarchies. You know, the Pope has all full power. Control.
But certainly you could argue that people from outside of the Vatican, I wouldn't call it a diaspora, can kind of talk a little bit about what they hope and want from the Vatican, but no other place. It's amazing. Anyway, I got sidetracked there.
No, I really appreciate it. And just to, you know, bring us back to the Torah portion one more time, I think that there is something really incredible about this conversation that we had of going from this emotional darkness, going from this despair, this dread, this awfulness into this grief, this cry erupting from all over Egypt, into this conversation about hope and aspirations and continually bettering ourselves and our people and our land and our community. I think that that's a really wonderful progression that we really do see within this Torah portion.
HaTikvah's our national anthem. Right. HaTikvah's our national anthem. It's hope, 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 hope. Anyway, sorry.
Hope. All of the hope. I love it. It's been HaTikvah since before the State of Israel was founded through today. It hasn't changed. We are always hoping. We didn't stop singing HaTikvah. We didn't stop saying that there will be this state, there will be, we're hoping for it continually. We didn't stop hoping. I really do love that. Before we wrap up this segment, I do need to ask you, if there were one message, one nugget of wisdom, one something that you wanted to leave listeners with when they, you know, turn off their podcasting device, what would that be? What's your message? What's your call to action?
Based upon our conversation, I would say, and look, I understand that perhaps there are people who are rabbinic students who are listening to this, or just, and or people who are not, you know, clergy, rabbis, anybody. I would say my would be that I think it's okay to study the Torah and the Bible with two hats on at the same time. I think it's okay to care deeply about biblical criticism and about history and about what may have been the reality of something, and hold that in one hand and at the same time hold in the other hand the recognition that we have created the story to be the foundational story of our people. And we don't need it to be historically perfect. Because what we need is that it to have a story to gather around and to unify and unite our people. And so to have a conversation about what darkness means, working from the perspective that that actually happened. And so what did that darkness mean? Versus another story, which was like, I'm not so sure any of these plagues really happened, because I think that we were, you know, I think you can have both, you can hold both together and be enriched by both parts and come out greater as a result. You don't need to commit yourself to one side and say, oh, because I believe in the history, that it wasn't a historical document, I throw out everything. Or the other side, which is, oh, this is God's word, and therefore I refuse to kind of consider or open my mind to the possibility that there was a reality beyond what this text is. I think you can hold both in your hands at the same time.
Holding two truths. That's a nice message. All right. This week on Midrashic Mixology, we are proud to present to you, Ari and Idan, and all of our listeners, Egyptian Darkness. Start off with a handful of blackberries, maybe 10 of them, and muddle them up in a cocktail shaker for the blood painted on the doorposts. Add in 3 ounces of dark rum for the titular darkness, 1.5 ounces of lemon juice for the bitterness of the final plague, and 1/2 ounce of honey for the promised land ahead. For a non-alcoholic version, use the same 1.5 ounces of lemon juice and 1/2 ounce of honey with 3 ounces of pomegranate juice. This one will be slightly more blood than darkness, but definitely still fits. Either way, shake it up with ice and strain over fresh ice in a highball glass. Top off with 6 ounces, or really whatever fits in the glass, of ginger beer. Fun fact, ancient Egyptians flavored their ancient ale with ginger and honey. Cool. Garnish with a lemon twist for the winding road ahead. This drink is great for every day, but it's also totally kosher for Passover, so keep this one on file. And as always, l'chaim.
Sounds good. I don't know who would want it without the rum, though, but the zero proof version of it.
We always make sure to have both a boozy and non-boozy option for our listeners who choose not to partake for whatever reason.
You should take a poll, you know, like put a, you know, a poll out there somehow that asks, you know, who likes the you know, the boozy version versus who likes the zero proof version.
I think there are probably a few of our drinks. I mean, we've done enough of them now. I feel like there are probably a few of them where the non-alcoholic version might be better than the alcoholic one.
Anytime tequila is involved.
Oh, okay. See, I always make a joke about tequila always represents bad things when I put it in a drink. I say tequila for this bad thing. And if you don't know why, then you've never had tequila. And it's always like a funny joke.
I agree with that. There's no doubt about it. Sounds like a delicious cocktail. I'm gonna give it a try.
Believe it or not, it is that time. Thank yous and closing cues. So before we say goodbye, I want to ask Ari Idan, in Parashat Bo, the Israelites paint blood on the doorposts of their house to mark their homes so that God will pass over them and the plague will only affect the Egyptians. It sounds kind of gross, the blood painting. I've heard it connected to the ritual of the mezuzah, putting up a mezuzah on your door. So we know that there are a lot of different identity and cultural markers that we put up, whether that's the mezuzah or something else. So I'm curious what you think we can do to mark ourselves and our spaces as Jewish while still welcoming in outsiders, while maybe not being so hostile, maybe not creating so much darkness. Ari, if it's all right, I'd love to start with you.
Yeah, sure. You know, it's like, by the way, you know that verse about, you know, putting the blood on the doorposts, it says the blood will be to you as a sign on the houses. And the sages talk about, they say, you know, lachem velo la'acharim, you know, for you and not for others. And so, you know, there was a midrashic understanding that actually you put the blood on the inside of your doorposts and not on the outside so you could see it. And there's like a part of me which thinks, you know, that kind of follows what you're talking about, which is what are the signs that for us, that remind us that we live in a Jewish context, in a Jewish community. For me, I think it wouldn't surprise you to know that I would say, you know, it's like, you know, the more you connect with Israel, the more that you know your history and the more that you know your people certainly will give you a much stronger connection to who you are and your Jewish identity, I think.
Idan, what do you think of these signs and identity markers?
Well, what I was thinking of actually does take cues from what Ari was saying, which is about these ways that we mark ourselves as Jewish don't necessarily have to be outward, right? Obviously, most Jews I know are very proud to be Jewish. Many will wear some sort of necklace or something, as Gabe is, with a Star of David or a Chamsa or something. And that's kind of their outward way of showing, I'm Jewish. I give a thumbs up. Not everybody has to do that, right? And so I don't necessarily wear something that is inherently Jewish outwardly all the time. But I do things for myself in my day-to-day life that I see and that are for me. And I think that once you get to be more comfortable with yourself and your own Judaism, it makes it much easier to be able to invite other Jews and other non-Jews in to your world and what that's like and be able to show, here's what it's like to be Jewish and here's how I do this and that, and this means this to me, et cetera.
You know, I'm a person who, as Idan said, I wear my Jewish star necklace. That's usually under my shirt, though. But I do wear a yarmulke most days. I wear a kippah. And that's been something I've done since college. And when I was an undergrad, I was the only one on campus who wore one every day. And that was definitely an interesting experience because it immediately marked me as somebody who was different. Now living in Brooklyn, it's, you know, slightly less uncommon, but certainly getting on the train, it still marks me. That said, I think the most powerful identity markers for me aren't necessarily the things I wear or the things that change my physical appearance, but the things that I do. And I would like to think that being Jewish, that a identity marker is how we act. It's how we treat the stranger. It's how we take care of one another. It's how we take care of those in need. And so for me, I would hope that the identity markers that I wear are less significant to people than how I act toward them. And I would hope that my actions reflect the values that I see as inherent in my Judaism. So that's kind of where I am with identity markers. Before we end, I do want to say this has been a really incredible conversation. I've really enjoyed my time tonight. Ari, if people want to continue the conversation, how can they find or follow you?
I think they can find me by going to our temple's website, and then you can find my email there, so which is annapolistemple.org. That's an easy way to find me. There's no doubt about it. Annapolistemple.org.
Amazing. You'll also find me there, so that's great.
My Instagram, I don't have any, I don't follow anybody. I only follow my own children on Instagram. So finding me on Instagram would not make a lot of sense, I don't think.
All right, Ari, any last thoughts, feelings, concerns, or jokes?
You would think I would have a lot of jokes, but instead I'll go a little serious. Judah Halevi, you know, the medieval poet and philosopher, wrote the expression, which is really one of my favorites and has always stayed with me, Libi b'mizrach v'anochi b'sof ma'arav. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it means, you know, my heart is in the East and I am stuck here in the West. Oftentimes I feel that way, you know, when your heart is in Israel and you are somewhere away from Israel and you have this yearning to be in Israel. And I think that's probably what the Israelites felt leaving Egypt. And I know it's what many generations of people have felt ever since then.
This has been a super fun conversation for me. One of my favorite things to do, much like Ari, is just delve into text, like really dive deep. And I think what's really fun about this episode in particular is that not only did we dive deep into the text, did we like really analyze and think about what does this darkness mean? What is this plague? Is it a plague? How do we deal with that? And also talking about, as Ari did, this mixed multitude, talking about these various ideas that come up in the Torah portion in a really in-depth, critical way, and yet still holding some reverence. That's something that we aim to do every week. With the distilled Parsha summary, I've often worried, you know, am I getting too sarcastic here? Am I getting too irreverent? And I hope that I'm not. I hope that it comes across as fun and lighthearted and funny and still reverent, still thinking deeply about these stories and about these laws and these ideas that are so foundational. You know, as Ari said, this is the story of our people, and this is really where we kick off. Everything else has just been a buildup to leaving Egypt and entering the promised land. So there's something really phenomenal about that. I had a biblical archaeology teacher back in the year in Israel, so this was almost 5 years ago now, who said to us, the story of the Exodus isn't 100% historically accurate, but there's no way there's no truth to it. There's no way. And we said, how can you possibly know that? You just said there was no archaeological evidence. How can you possibly know? And he goes, because what group of people would start off their national narrative, their foundational story, by saying that they were slaves? What group of people would choose to do that if it weren't true in some way? I love the way that Ari framed that. I love the way that he took this story that really positions the Israelites as the underdog, as the Cinderella, as the real downtrodden group, and brings them eventually to the promised land. But we know that there is still a lot of hardship to come. There's a lot of stuff that's going to happen. We know that we'll reach the Sea of Reeds and there will be more trouble, and then a miracle will happen, and then we'll get through to the other side, and then there will be more trouble, and we'll keep wandering. And yet, we're always hoping, we're always moving forward. And so I really do enjoy that we ended with that conversation of aspiration, of hatikva, the hope that we are constantly improving. You know, I heard a Devar Torah once from Rabbi Joel Sissonwine, who said, our response to when bad things happen in Israel, by which he meant when the Israeli government does things we disagree with, we can't just cut Israel off. Because if you had a family member who did something bad, you wouldn't just cut off that family member. You wouldn't just say, okay, well, you're done. Instead, you would embrace that person and you would say, listen, you did something bad and it's time for growth. In Rabbi Sissonwine's words, you would love that person more. You would give them more of your love, more of your attention. And so I am as concerned, if not more so, than a lot of the people I see commenting and posting on my Facebook and Twitter and Instagram feeds, people talking about the new right-wing government, the new coalition in Israel, and about how it's really concerning for minority populations, for LGBT plus populations, for progressive Jews living in Israel. It's a really concerning moment in Israeli politics. And with the understanding that my voice might not always be welcome as a Reform Jew, as a person who is aspiring to be a leader in Reform Judaism, well, I recognize that my perspective won't be the dominant one in Israeli politics. I need to understand that my role cannot be to simply cut Israel off. My role can't simply be to throw up my arms and say, well, that didn't work. Instead, I have to pay more attention. I have to love it more. I have to give it more of my time, more of my attention, because that's how we make a difference. That's how we make an impact, not by stopping the conversation, but by continuing it. So if you're looking forward to continuing the conversation, we would love to see you back here next week on Drinking and Droshing Torah with a Twist on all of your favorite podcasting platforms. If your preferred podcasting platform is Apple Podcasts, we would love it if you would give us a rating and a review. It really helps us not only, reach the top of the charts and get more people listening, but also helps us, tells us what we're doing right, maybe what we're not doing right. If you want to reach out to us, there is a contact page on our website, as well as our store, store.drinkinganddroshing.com, and a bunch of different ways to support us, all at drinkinganddroshing.com. So with that, I wish you a very good week. L'chaim.
L'chaim.
Hi, I'm Rabbi Ari Goldstein, and you're listening to Drinking and Droshing, Torah with a Twist, and stay away from tequila. I assure you, you'll be happier that you did.